Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. This one is on Romans chapters 5 to 8, and I have titled it The Heresy of Hope. So if you've been with us the last couple of weeks, you know that we've been talking about the book of Romans, and that Romans is a difficult letter to read. In fact, N.T. Wright talks about the central challenge of reading Romans is keeping Paul's arguments in mind as you read about the minute details of his arguments. And I have found it's personally helpful to remember that Romans is built on a thesis supported by four arguments. And so we read that thesis as we talked about 2 weeks ago in Romans 1:17, where Paul writes, "For in faith for all, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith." Now that thesis statement uses the word faith a lot. But what it means is that God has been faithful to humanity and return requires trust. And that trust that God has been faithful to humanity reveals a life that is worth living. Paul then supports this thesis through four arguments that are chapters long. The first one is Romans 1 to 4. The second one is Romans 5 to 8. Third is Romans 9 to 11. And the fourth is Romans 12 to 15. And last week, we talked about Paul's first argument in Romans 1 to 4. And it's there that Paul tries to move the idea of religion from external devotion to personal inner reflection. In other words, what Paul says Christianity is that Christianity holds up a mirror to the Christian and asks the question, how are you part of the problem? That's the purpose of Christianity for Paul. And when you look at how Romans 1 to 4 supports Paul's thesis, Romans 1 to 4 tells us that a life worth living begins by confronting our own ignorance, our own blindness, our own problems, and asking us to change. Because it's really difficult to change other people, but it's really possible to change one's own behavior. So that's the first argument in Paul's letter to the Romans. And today we're going to talk about Romans 5 to 8, Paul's second argument that supports his thesis. Now, it's important when we read the book of Romans to remember where Romans came from. Romans was most likely written in the city of Corinth around 55 CE. Corinth is in modern-day Greece and is a bridge between two major land masses within Greece. So Paul writes this letter from Greece to the church in Rome, which is in Italy, but I think you knew that. And when he writes this letter, he's writing to a group of people he's never met because he's hoping to build a good rapport with these Romans so that he might use Rome as a launching pad to launch his mission into Spain in the near future. Now, it's important when we read the book of Romans in the Bible today that we must remember that we are not the intended audience of this letter. Romans was not written for us. We have a temptation to believe that everything is about us, but to make that assumption with the letter to the Romans is dangerous. So dangerous, in fact, that the church knew about this danger. That is why they entitled the letter the Epistle to the Romans. They didn't want you to forget that this is not written for you. It was written to a specific church at a specific time with specific intent. And Paradox is not the Roman church. Paradox is a church that is in Redlands in 2018 on the other side of the globe in Southern California. So when we read Romans, it's important to remember that it's not written for us. But a really good question to ask while we read Romans is, how would this letter to the Romans be different if we in Redlands were the intended audience? That's a real good question to ask if you're serious about Bible study. Why? Because it is there that you'll start to get at the inspiration and the intent behind the letter and how it applies to us today. So during this podcast, I'm going to take the theology of Paul and do my best to keep the theology of Romans 5 to 8 intact and yet change the words so it's written specifically to people that might be living in Redlands in 2018. Now, because of that, we could assume that if Paul were writing to us today, that the message would be the same, the theology would be the same, but the medium, the words he chose, would be very different. So I'm going to teach in a way that keeps that theology intact, and I'll go paragraph by paragraph through Romans 5 to 8, and I'll discuss to the best of my ability the theology and how it looks and moves and breathes within a life in America in 2018. Now, before we do that, there's a couple disclaimers I want to have. You may be listening to this podcast and you may think to yourself, I knew it. I heard Craig Hadley was a heretic, and now I know that Craig Hadley is a heretic. And I'll say, I understand that, and I hope that you get there, and I hope this sounds a little bit like heresy, because we have to remember that Paul, the author of this letter and his theology, was considered heresy over and over and over again by the religious establishment of his day. This man, Paul, was a heretic, and he was chased from town to town and beaten over and over again because he kept preaching in their eyes what was heresy. So if the theology that I'm about to share with you during this teaching sounds like heresy, I want you to know that I'm being as true to the original heresy as I possibly can. So that's the first disclaimer. The second disclaimer is that I have a friend that I have spoken about often on this podcast. His name is Tyler Fullerton, and he's one of my best friends, and he's an agnostic. Now, Tyler, several years ago, walked away from Christianity because he felt like it was impossible to believe in an all-powerful, all-loving God in a world where there is so much suffering and pain and evil. And I've heard this critique and concern from several agnostics. And when I first heard this from Tyler was when I was in college, and it was all the way back in 2005. And I remember trying to answer the question and solve the problem and try and tell him, yeah, but all of these things. And I learned that that's the wrong way to go about it. And what I wish I would have known in 2005, back then, you know, 13 years ago now, is I wish I would have known Romans 5-8. Because I believe that Romans 5-8 was written for that question. How can you believe in an all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing God in a world where there is suffering, pain, heartache, and evil? I think it's important for us to keep that question in mind as we study Romans 5-8, because these four chapters are what this question was written for, about faith in the face of suffering. So with that in mind, I'd like to teach from Romans 5-8 as if it was written to a church in Redlands in 2018. My brothers and my sisters, I am writing to you, I am speaking to you, I am recording this podcast to tell you three words. Hope is real. Now, this may seem difficult in light of the horrendous suffering that you and I have faced. And throughout my journeys, I have been chased and persecuted, and people have told me that I am a heretic. But I am here to tell you that when I believe that hope is real, over and over again, I have found that this hope is not an exercise in vanity. It is not a security blanket. It is not something that passes by lightly. But believing that hope is real is where a life that is worth living is found. Because while you may be discouraged, or you may be hurting, or you may be betrayed, I'm here to tell you to remember the gospel. Because at the crux of the gospel is this big idea that changes everything, that God meets us in the weakness of our humanity. God doesn't meet us when we get everything right. God, surprise of all surprises, meets us when we get things wrong. And when we go through this world, there are failures, and there are times we let our loved ones down, and there are times we don't get things right. But I am here to tell you that I have found the gospel is true, and God meets us in the weakness of our humanity. Now, I'd like to ask you a question as you listen to this podcast. We are in a brand new year in 2018. And when you look back on the past year of your life, what trials did you face? Did you go through a breakup? A divorce? Did you lose a friend? Did a loved one pass away? Did you fail on an exam? Were you betrayed? 2017, for many people, was a year of terrible trial, was a year filled with pain, was a year that if given the opportunity, you may not go back and live again. I want you to know as your pastor, I understand. And I've been there. I have been dumped. I have been lost. I have had things fail around me. I have been fired from a job that I loved. And I'm pointing these things out, and I'm asking you to reflect on this past year and the pain it has caused, because I'd like to tell you what I have found to be true in this life. I have found that suffering and pain and heartache and evil are all real, are all part of this existence, are all part of living on this planet. Evil is real. And if anyone ever tries to explain that this is a mere passing, or that you should get over your pain, or that things will always work out for those who love God, I'm here to tell you that I have not found that to be the case, because I have felt pain as well. My brothers and my sisters, suffering, pain, heartache, and evil are all real. But then I'd like to ask you a second question. In the past year, what triumphs did you celebrate? Because just a few weeks ago, my son, Bodie, walked for the very first time. And it is an amazing miracle to watch your son walk for the first time. Not only that, but a few weeks ago as well, I was able to go on a date with my daughter. And we spent the entire day in Disneyland, just the two of us. And when it's just the two of us, we can go on as many rides as we want without ever taking a break. Can I get an amen? We went on Mater's ride 3 times, Jumping Jellyfish 3 times, the swings twice. We went on the Cars ride. We went on the merry-go-round. We went on whatever my daughter wanted to. And within Disneyland, there is an opportunity to meet Anna or Elsa in the animation building. So we waited in line because my daughter loves Frozen, and we went inside the room, and it wasn't Anna or Elsa. It was Anna and Elsa. It was a great day at Disneyland. I never wanted this day to end. And as we are walking out, my daughter turns to me in her 4-year-old innocent nature, and she says to me, "Daddy, can you please buy me some mini ears, Daddy? Please, Daddy." And my mind immediately thought to myself, "Oh my word, we are not participating in this consumerist economy. If we were to go and buy these ears, you would enjoy them for just a few fleeting moments, but it wouldn't bring you eternal happiness. No, we're not going to buy any ears." But my heart said, "Don't you want something to commemorate this day forever?" And so just a few moments later, I was buying some overpriced mini ears, and my daughter wears them, and she looks adorable now. And there are times that the heart is stronger than the mind, isn't there? I'm telling you these things because a lot of us get confused when pastors tell these stories, because they feel like pastors are saying that the summation of what a human being can do is have children and love them. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm telling you these stories because the most valuable thing in my life are relationships of love. And these relationships of love remind me how good life on earth can be. And these relationships are one of many things on this planet that remind me that there is an inherent goodness within our existence as well. Because while we said that suffering and pain and heartache and evil are real, I have also found that grace and love and beauty and goodness are also real. And it's important for us to acknowledge that we live in a world filled with grace and suffering. And for too long, I've often heard of a Christianity that acknowledges either grace and ignores suffering, or acknowledges suffering and ignores grace. When Christianity accepts and embraces suffering but ignores grace, the theology in the life that you get is one that sounds like a doomsday theology. It's one that talks about how terrible the world is and how God is going to come back and make things right, and it's going to burn this planet because it's such a miserable speck of dust in this solar system. whenever you hear somebody speaking in the way that God hates earth, that's usually a Christianity that ignores grace and just talks about suffering. Conversely, when you have a Christianity that embraces only grace and never acknowledges suffering, then you get a religion that is thin and shallow and fluffy. This Christianity is resembled in Christian music radio. The whole idea behind Christian music radio is the idea that you can only play positive hits because we all are filled with the grace of Jesus and nothing can prove us wrong. It's just positive, positive, positive all the time. And it wears you out, doesn't it? Because you know that life is not all about positive hits. Instead, we live in a world that is much more like basketball. When we talk about basketball, I have to confess, as your pastor, I'm a terrible basketball player. I retired a few years ago because I'm so bad at this sport. But when we talk about basketball, it's important for us to acknowledge what makes basketball worth playing. Imagine for a moment that it was impossible to miss in basketball. And everything was good, and anytime you threw the ball up toward the net, it would always go in. We may play that sport for a few seconds, maybe a few minutes. But after a while, we'd be bored. We'd be bored because it's impossible to miss, and therefore everything would be good, and it wouldn't really be a sport that's worth playing. Conversely, imagine that basketball was impossible, and no matter what people did, they never made a shot, and every shot became a missed shot. If that was the case, then basketball would be so depressing, would be such an exercise in futility that very few people would stick with it. Because why play basketball if you can never make a shot? No, the whole reason that we play basketball and watch basketball is because the moment the ball is shot and put in the air is the moment we all hold our breath and look toward the rim as we wait to see whether the ball will go in or whether the ball will stay out. Basketball requires made shots and missed shots in order to be basketball. And if you take away one or the other, then you no longer have a game that is worth playing. Basketball's value comes from the fact that we may make it or we may miss it. In the same way, my brothers and sisters, life works in this world. We live in a world filled with grace and suffering. And some people may ask you to explain suffering in the presence of an all-powerful, all-loving God, and it's impossible. Because if you talk about a life and an existence on this planet without grace or without suffering, it is something that does not make sense and does not work for this reality. But what I have found as your pastor is that Christianity speaks and works and moves and lives in this world caught between grace and suffering. Now you may ask me how I know this to be true, and I would point to the cross. The cross is our proof that God is with us in the midst of a world caught between grace and suffering. And it is on the cross that God embraces all that life has to offer. God embraces betrayal and sacrificial love and pain and heartache and hope and joy. In other words, it's on the cross that God embraces the full spectrum of humanity. And if you want to know what it means to be Christian, Christianity embraces the full spectrum of humanity. Christianity embraces suffering. And Christians weep and cry out to God and scream toward the heavens and ask questions like, where is God in the midst of so much pain? And at the same time, Christians embrace the fullness of life and the goodness of what it means to be alive. Christians throw great dinner parties. Christians love recklessly. Christians learn how to forgive those who don't deserve forgiveness. When everybody else writes someone off, Christians are the first to begin to figure out a way to love them. Christianity, when it follows the cross, is a religion that embraces the full spectrum of humanity. Now, at this point, you may say, wait a second, doesn't the cross mean that I am free to sin in any way and that God will forgive me no matter what I do? No, that's not what the cross is. Instead, the cross is our reminder that God is found in the midst of suffering. Now, this may sound counterintuitive or illogical, and I would agree with you 100%. But at the same time, think about how true this actually is. God is found in the midst of our suffering. This paradox is beautifully illustrated by the incomparable poet Nayira Wahid in her poem, The Freedom in Fear. She writes, "When I am afraid to speak is when I speak. That is when it is most important." And she recognizes that when she feels fearful to speak out, it is that fear that brings meaning and importance and power and value to the words that she writes. In other words, what she's saying is the more fear there is, the more important my words become. And God is found in the midst of our suffering. And so once you embrace this world of grace and suffering and embrace the full spectrum of humanity, there will be a question that arises in your mind. Which is more powerful? Which is the real story? Grace or suffering? And this is a very important question to ask. And you may come to me as your pastor and ask this question: which is more of the ultimate reality, grace or suffering? To which I would respond, that is entirely up to you. Because it's here that you are at a crossroads, and you get to decide which road to go down. My brothers and my sisters, if you believe that suffering is the real story, then that faith, that trust in suffering, will ultimately lead to despair. The great Charlie Chaplin, in a 1947 film, is quoted as saying, "Despair is a narcotic. It lulls the mind into indifference." If you trust that suffering is the real story, that it's more powerful than grace, that the end game of our existence is pain, then that road leads to apathy, to indifference, to asking the question, what's the point of this all anyways? And that trust in suffering is a choice that you make, and it's up to you whether you trust suffering or not. And while that may sound discouraging, I'd like to return to those crossroads where you're asking the question, which one is the real story, suffering or grace? Because if you believe that grace is the real story, then that faith and that trust in grace will lead to a life worth living. Now, this is good news for all my agnostic brothers and sisters out there. Because if you are an agnostic and you've heard about Christianity and you've been told that Christianity needs you to suspend your belief and trust in science in order to be a Christian, that is not what I'm getting at here. All you have to do is trust that grace is the real story, that grace has dominion over suffering, and that this world and this life is worth living. Why? Because in this reality between suffering and grace, you trust and believe and act in a way that trusts grace. That, my brothers and sisters, is what leads to a life that is beautiful and merciful and humble and enjoyable. Now, at this point, the religious brothers and sisters may hear me speaking to the agnostic brothers and sisters and say, hang on a minute, what about religion? Because we're going to church every week. We want some sort of credit for this. To which I would turn to my religious brothers and sisters, and with a smile on my face and in the most compassionate tone possible, say these words: if you are religious, then please allow your religion to die. Let it go. Now, I understand that this makes me sound like Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi, where he turns to Rey and says, it's time for the Jedi to end. And you may say to yourself, oh, but I kind of like the Jedi. I want the Jedi to be around for a while. Why are we asking the Jedi to end? And if you're asking me, you may say, Craig, are you really still quoting Romans? Because this doesn't sound like orthodoxy. This sounds like heresy, to which I would say, remember that Paul was a heretic. There's a reason people wanted to kill him, because he told religious people to allow their religion to die. And you may ask the question, why, Craig, why would Paul tell people to allow their religion to die? I think this is captured by Richard Rohr, who is a Franciscan priest who lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he is quoted as saying, religion is often the easiest place to hide from God, which is the theological equivalent of, come at me, bro. And that may sound counterintuitive, it may sound wrong, but we know it's true. Religion is often the easiest place to hide from God. Think about this. Where is it the easiest in America to stand up in front of a group of people right now and say, I hate gay people? Without a doubt, the safest, most accepting place to express your hatred toward gay people is a church. And what's so strange about this is that we often talk about how God is love and God is acceptance, and that God requires us to learn how to love people in brand new ways that we never thought was possible before. And religion comes along and allows a space, a safe space, for people to hide from God and say, you know what I hate? I hate gay people. It is here, when we look at the religious landscape in America in 2018, that we hear Richard Rohr say religion is often the easiest place to hide from God, and we say amen. I know. I found that to be true. So when Paul tells us that if you are religious, then allow your religion to die, we have all experienced that at some point or another. Because when we look at the life of Jesus, Jesus didn't come to this earth, did not live in flesh and blood and walk among us so that we might become more religious. Notice that Jesus didn't say, hey guys, you know what's really important? Study your Bible more and make sure you show up every week to church because I want to see your religious devotion. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus came so that we might have life in a world caught between grace and suffering. Now, at this point, the religious person may say, come on, there's got to be some purpose to religion. And I would say, of course there is. And in order to talk about the purpose of religion, I'd like to tell you a story. A story I'd like to tell you happened at a Rob Bell conference, because I am such a Rob Bell fan that I go to Rob Bell conferences. Rob Bell is one of my favorite authors, and he talks about faith and spirituality and life in this world here and now as inspired by Jesus Christ. And these conferences are designed for speakers to learn how to speak in a better way, because I need to continually evolve and adapt and learn how to speak in better ways, because, you know, it's my job. And it was here that one guy that was near the front asked Rob a question, and it's a question I will never forget. He raised his hand, Rob Bell called on him, and he said, hey, Rob, I have this problem where I tell personal stories when I preach, and in all of these stories, I end up being the hero. How do I, Rob, tell stories where I'm not the hero all the time? Now, at this point, if you were to interview me, if you were to pause everything that was happening and say, Craig, what do you think about this right now? I would say, well, that guy's voice sounds like nails scratching across a chalkboard for an interminable amount of time. This question greatly annoyed me. Here's a guy sitting on the front row saying, I am just so great. How can you help me tell stories where I'm not so great? This question annoyed me to my core. And what I've learned as I've grown older is to not ignore my annoyances. Instead, to accept them and then ask important questions like this. Why does this man annoy me? Because I am allowing this man to annoy me, and he's just asking a question. So why am I allowing this person to annoy me? The reason this man annoyed me is because of what the purpose of religion is, according to Paul. And the purpose of religion is to remind the religious person of their human need for grace. And so when a pastor sits on the front row of a conference and says, I don't need any grace because I'm the hero all the time. What they're doing is they're ignoring the purpose of religion. And so I was annoyed because here's a pastor proclaiming that he's a pastor, and yet he's completely missing the point of how he's supposed to lead. Now, at this point, I have a choice to make. I can point at that guy that's sitting on the front row and say, that guy's the problem. We need to remove his credentials. We need to disfellowship him. We need to kick him out of the church to make an example out of him and to prove that this is not what religion is about. But if you read Romans 1-4, you have completely missed the point of what Paul is talking about, because Paul talks about how Christianity holds up a mirror to every Christian and asks, how am I part of the problem? So instead, what I have to do is I have to hold up a mirror to myself and say, Craig, as a speaker, do you only tell stories where you're the hero all the time? How do you communicate to your congregation, Craig, that you are in need of grace just like everyone else? Because if I refuse to acknowledge that, because if I look inward and I say, well, you know, I'm pretty good and I tell stories where I'm the hero all the time, then I come across as annoying others. And it is only because of religion that I can reflect and look inward and say to myself, you know what? I've told far too many stories where I'm the hero all the time. The purpose of religion is to remind the religious person of their human need for grace. Now, one other thought on this idea. Christianity has 2,000 years of history in which they are guilty for saddling human beings with guilt. As a pastor, I want to tell you today that I am sorry. When Paul speaks about the purpose of religion to remind people of their need for grace, he's not writing this to make people feel guilty about their existence. What he is doing is he's talking about the importance of trusting grace. And it's impossible to give grace away unless we ourselves have received grace. And there's nothing wrong with being human, but there is everything wrong with believing that we are superhuman. And so what religion does is religion holds up a mirror to you and to me and asks us to reflect and understand how we have let other people down and how we can grow and improve and change and move things. And when this happens, grace bursts into our heart and demands some very difficult things, doesn't it? Because grace demands that there's times that you give up your power. Grace demands there's times that you stand up for yourself and say, hey, it's important that you recognize me as a child of God, because for too long, my people, my gender, my race, my group has been ignored. And grace doesn't just passively accept all things. Instead, grace demands dramatic and difficult changes to our lives, doesn't it? And the fact is that when grace bursts in, it really, really challenges you and me to change and to move and to grow in a way that aligns our way, not with suffering, but with grace. And what I have found is that as a pastor, I thought it would be real easy to always choose grace all the time, and I'm here to tell you that's not the case. And there's times that grace has demanded something dramatic and difficult from me, and in fear, I chose the wrong path. I didn't do the right thing. There are times in my life that I have ignored grace or suppressed grace in order to maintain my job, my paycheck, my title. And in fear, I have chosen the wrong thing. If you in fear have ever chosen the thing that grace would not have you do, I am telling you on this podcast one thing. Remember the gospel. Remember, when you have chosen the wrong thing, that God meets us in the weakness of our humanity. God does not give up on you. God does not backtrack. God does not change the rules once you accept God. God meets us in our weaknesses, and when we in fear make the wrong decision, God embraces us and meets us there too. And I'm speaking to you as your pastor today to tell you that when I speak to you and interact with you and see you, what I see is the real story about you. And the real story is not a vessel of pain or a vessel of anger or a vessel of evil. What I see when I look at you is that you, my brother, you, my sister, are a vessel of grace. That is your identity. And you live in this world caught between grace and suffering, and there's times that you and I contribute to other people's suffering in this world. That is not the real story of who you are. God did not create us to be miserable screw-ups. God created us as imperfect and human vessels of grace. And when you look at creation, all of creation, creation in the same way is an imperfect and beautiful vessel of grace. And creation is caught in this reality with us between suffering and grace. But you know what creation does? Creation is a word that's a Greek word. And the Greek word is soustenazo, which means to groan together. Now, soustenazo is an interesting word because groaning doesn't happen if you're dead. It's impossible to groan if you're dead, so you are alive. And because you are alive, there is some grace in you. But you also don't groan unless you are in pain. And so soustenazo speaks to the fact that someone is alive and yet in pain. But then the groaning also implies that it's going toward something. What is that something? It is the Greek word elpizo, which means hope. Hope. The groaning is a result that the world longs for something better. And when God searches the hearts of men and women, what God is looking for is not perfection, is not religious devotion. It is not the ability to say all sorts of scripture verses. Instead, what God is searching for is soustenazo, a heart that hurts and a heart that heals, a heart that breaks and a heart that gives, a heart that hopes in the face of suffering and grace. Because my brothers and sisters, in the world's groaning and hope and suffering and grace giving and receiving, the work of God is grace for all of humanity. And I am here to tell you that after I've been beaten and tried and left for dead by the religious establishment, that I would do it all over again. Why? Because I have found that grace prevails over suffering time and time again. And yes, suffering still exists, but grace has made this life worth living. And when I say that grace prevails over suffering, so often people misunderstand me and they believe that grace precludes you from suffering. That's just not true. Grace does not preclude you from suffering. Instead, grace drives you toward suffering. As the great Dave Chappelle once said, every friggin' person who takes a stand for somebody else always gets beat down. Christianity will always have you stand in solidarity with the oppressed. And when you stand up with the oppressed, you will always get beat down. And at that point, you may say, what's the point of that all anyways? Why shouldn't I just worry about myself? I'm not a racist. I'm not a sexist. Why stand if I'm always going to get beat down? I will tell you, because I have done my life doing this, and here's what I have found. Grace in the midst of suffering is where God is found. Grace in the midst of suffering is where God is found. I have found the cross to be the ultimate testament of reality here and now on this planet. Yes, there is suffering. Yes, there is grace. And when you drive toward suffering and do your best to be an agent of grace in the face of suffering,
That is where I have found God to be. Now, at this point, you may say, well, I'm not really religious. I'm not sure I'll find God there. Fine. I'm here to tell you what I have found to be true. Grace in the midst of suffering is where a life worth living is found. And we religious people use the word God to symbolize what a life worth living is. And so I'm not asking any of you agnostic brothers or sisters to suspend science and believe in something else. I'm just asking you to be grace in the world where suffering and grace are realities. And if you trust grace, you will find a life that is worth living over and over and over again. And why do I tell all of you this? Religious, non-religious, men, women, people of all different ethnic backgrounds, I tell you all of this for three simple words. Hope is real. Hope is real. Hope is real. 2,000 years ago, the Apostle Paul talked about grace in the midst of suffering and hope and the realness of hope. And in Romans 8, 37 to 39, he writes these words, "In all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." Paul says, "I have been persecuted, I have stood up for others, and I have been beat down, and in all of it, God is with me. This is not an exercise in futility. I would do it all over again if I was given the choice, because hope is real, and it is what's worth living for." My brothers and sisters, may you trust grace, and may you believe that hope is real, and may you find a life that is worth living. May you see and embrace Jesus Christ in all.